Good evening, everyone. This is Keith David, and you're listening to Without Your Head.
Station of Decapitation Without Your Head. I'm Nasty Neil, and I'm joined by legendary screenwriter and filmmaker Paul Schrader. It's very cool to have you here.
Thank you.
Well, what's interesting is it's the 40th anniversary of Cat People, and so when your Cat People was originally released, it was the 40th anniversary of the original Cat People.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, so it's weird to think that a movie from the 40s was as old then as a movie from the 80s is today.
Yeah, well, that is very, very true of things in general, because, I mean, I remember when I was editing a film magazine, and we got in touch with Joseph H. Lewis about doing an article about him. And he said, who sees those old movies anyway? Now, he was talking about movies that were 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, we're dealing with movies that are 50 years old that are as viewable as they were, more viewable than they were when they came out.
Yeah, it's very, because a movie from the 80s doesn't seem like a dated movie to me, but a movie from the 40s, obviously that's 80 years ago now, but it seems so much like a totally different time.
I mean, when I was in college, Casablanca was considered, you know, like an old movie, and Casablanca was 42, and that was 68, so that, you know, wasn't that far back.
Yeah. So, Cat People, that's the first movie that you directed that you didn't write.
So, I wrote Blue Collar and Hardcore. Yeah, the first one, yeah. Yes.
So, how did that come about? How did it come about that you'd be involved with Cat People?
Well, in the war, Universal offered it to me, and because American Gigolo had done well. And I thought it'd be fun to do something not so personal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
To do a genre piece.
Why is it?
Of course, in the end, I think it is as personal or more personal than the others.
Hmm. How so?
But that was my original inclination, was say, oh, okay, I'll just do this horror genre piece and get off from the self-examination pedestal.
Right. So how does that change then? You go in thinking, you know, I'm just going to make a genre movie. It's not going to be personal to me. And then it becomes personal. Is that something you can't help? You just, you know, add that to the movie?
Well, that's part of it, but also that I became besotted with nostalgia, and that kind of took over my life, and the film started becoming about that, and in fact that sort of precipitated the end of my Hollywood years, just because the complications of that romance and subsequent and coinciding drug use, that it was just time to leave Hollywood, and I did it. I'm a huge fan of Taxi Driver, I mean of Cat People, but you know, I do see it as the end of a chapter.
Mm-hmm. So how has your views of it changed over the years? Do you look at it differently now than you did when it first came out?
No, I've always liked it. I was always kind of put off by those. You know, there's always a collection of people who are going to say not as good as the original. Mm-hmm. And that's just, you know, that's just human nature. They're doing it now with Nightmare Alley. I mean, this version of Nightmare Alley is so much better than the Golden one. It's so much better. But, you know, there are going to be people who say, oh, it wasn't as good as the original. Mm-hmm. And I explained at the time that it came out, because I was dealing with that comparison, I said, you know, we should have just renamed it something else. And because we changed it so much, the only reason it gets compared to Cap People is because we kept the name, and also because we kept a series of homage scenes, you know, to the original. And those were put in intentionally, not because they were particularly good for the story, you know, like the streetcar and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I was always irritated by that kind of knee-jerk film buff reaction of, oh, not as good as the original, not as good as the original. I mean, I don't think it's even, I mean, it's technically comparable, but I don't think it's at all similar.
Mm-hmm.
Dissimilar themes.
Yeah.
And as I said, I feel the same way about the Nightmare Alley thing. So what has happened, I guess, that hurt the film when it came out, that comparison. And now that comparison has wilted away. And I've had very good fortune with quite a few films having good shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some films, you know, they seem to be so hot, and then, you know, 10 years later, you know, but what was Green Book? There was a movie called Green Book.
Right, yeah, one best movie, yeah.
Yeah. And other movies just, you know, hang around, and people keep refinding them, and they have shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Cat People, I keep saying Taxi Driver. Cat People has picked up shelf life. And also, part of it was a little outre at the time. You know, I changed the ending. And the original ending was kind of a genre ending where there was a big old house. The monster was trapped inside the house. They set fire to the house, and the monster died in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Monster being the cat.
Right.
And I just thought that was so hokey. And I was saying, you know, how about this? How about if he captures the monster, has sex with it, and then keeps it in a shrine so he can visit it?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, that is a much better ending. That is a really cool ending. So then I ended up with this kind of bondage scene where John is strapping Nastasia naked to a bed so that she won't kill him when she transforms. And then and David Bowie is, you know, singing all of this quasi-religious mumbo jumbo.
Uh-huh.
Ooh, yeah, and it's like some... was meant to be like some primal sacrificial ceremony.
Yeah, and that really works with the beginning of the movie, because then you have it bookended with both the sacrifices.
I do remember. I remember quite vividly that you know, we didn't do that much previewing back then, and Jerry Bruckheimer was the producer, and Jerry and I went on opening night to the Avco on Westwood in Los Angeles, And we were sitting way in the back, and in front of us were a couple of young girls, I would say maybe 17 or so. And it came to the ending. And when he starts tying her to the bed, and I do those sort of fetishistic close-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And the one girl turned to the other and just went, "Oh my God." I leaned over to Jerry and I said, "You know, Jerry, I think maybe we went a little too far."
Did you have any issues with the MPA releasing the movie with any of the sex scenes or nudity?
No, it was a little different then. I mean, sex was selling. Sex doesn't sell anymore. Nobody, but that was one of the days when people would go to the movies to see famous people naked. We don't do that anymore, and because we've got the internet. it was accepted as part of the rating system, mm-hmm. that, you know, sex was part of the commercial package of a film. And it's just a matter of how much sex you had, you know. And there were sort of guidelines. It was, you know, it would have these ludicrous guidelines like three thrusts is acceptable, four is unacceptable.
Right.
But it would literally get that picky. And no, we didn't have any problem with that, no.
Mm-hmm. Was interesting. I watch it again for the interview. I've seen it many times before, but you know, everyone's talked about the sexuality of the movie, obviously. But also, what I think's interesting is when you say the monster for the monster for the cat to become human again, it has to kill. So it's almost, you know, has sex to become an animal, but then to go back to being human, it's almost like to be human, you have to kill. And I think that's kind of a statement about humanity.
And. One of the interesting things is, you know, it's a pre-digital film,
mm-hmm.
and there was a period there where I kind of winced at it because, you know, it could be done so much better with later technology. But now I kind of like the fact that it is OG. And that, because if you would do that now, and I'm sure it will be done again because it's an evergreen, you know, with all the sophistication of digitized animals, it probably could become less fun because it becomes too easy, too slick,
mm-hmm.
you know, to the fact that, you know, that it's being faked, you know, with you know, with various devices, practical devices, you know, has kind of, I find it kind of comforting to see old school horror in the era of all digital green screen horror.
Oh, I agree 100%. That's something we talked about on the show, because I think with CG, there's always something about the weight not being there. And even like you can just tell it's not exactly there. And I always think even kind of bad practical effects have a charm to it, where a bad CG just looks bad.
Yeah. Yeah. In a strange way, it's kind of humanizing because you know that you know there's actually actors under all that makeup trying to make this work.
Right. Yeah, there's a charm to that. How about just the difficulties of filming a leopard?
They are nocturnal and arboreal.
Okay.
So there's a lot of difficulties. And they are not in any way trainable.
Mm-hmm.
So had a couple black leopards, one of whom was crazy, and had to be put down. You see him, in fact, die in the film. He charged the cages had to were real cages, really secure cages, because these are dangerous animals. And he charged straight at the camera and split open to his forehead. And that was a black leopard. But for the stuff outside, we used mountain lions dyed black.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So because those you could kind of, they're not nocturnal, they're not arboreal. You can sort of, get them to do certain things in a limited way, whereas you everything that dealt with the real big cats had to be hyper secure. And I once asked one of the trainers, I said, how will I know if something's going wrong? And he said, you'll see me running.
That's very comforting. Yeah.
But the cat at the very end, that's a leopard. The cat in the cave at the beginning, that's a leopard. There's a couple of other leopards that we were able to use. But once we got into, hitting marks and stuff like that, you couldn't use a real leopard.
Yeah. So how about casting the movie? Because, I was saying sex sells and Natasha Kinski obviously looks great. But you also have to have an innocence of the character because she's a virgin in the movie, not to spoil a 40-year-old movie. So was that a hard role to cast?
Well, I mean, she was so beautiful. I mean, I remember saying to the photographer that we don't even somebody's trying to interrupt. I'm going to. No. So, hello, are you still there?
Yep.
I said the cinematographer, I said, we don't have to put any light in these scenes. Just have Nastasia there. She lights it herself. I mean, that's how besotted I was. But it is true. She is just at that moment kind of incandescent. And I thought that my job as director was to somehow, this is why I got in trouble, because I got this notion that if she was full of the love I felt for her, that love would go immediately onto the screen and the audience would feel it too. Now, there's some truth in that, but there's also some crazy delusion in it, too.
Mm-hmm. So,
I think most...
Go on, sorry.
But most men have been there.
Mm-hmm. You said this is why you got in trouble. Was there something with you and Natasha while you're filming this?
Yeah. I had been living with her. I was going to get married, and then I started... affair with Nastasia. And then I broke it off, and I got my girlfriend, wife to be, to forgive me. And then I'm in the middle of editing the film, and the phone rings, and it's Nastasia, and she says, "I'm in Paris. I miss you. Will you come over?" And I went right to the airport. And so I knew that there was no forgiveness after that.
Yeah. So you talked earlier about, this is kind of like how you left Hollywood. So what was the point where you're like, was there a point like I need to get out of this, or were you kind of forced out, or was it like a decision? I have to get out of here for my own sanity.
It was very buggy time. And everybody I knew, was fighting it in some way. Some were dying, like John. You know, some were going to the hospital, like Marty. But it was very much of the moment, because there was a period there where people thought that cocaine was not addictive. But it is, just in a different way. You know, it destroyed Sam Peckinpah, and a lot of people were getting wiped out by it. And when that romantic thing came, when the wheels came off that wagon, the drug that I had been taking started taking me.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of the dark fantasies come up, and one day you say, if I don't leave this world, this town, I'm not going to make it out of here. Mm-hmm. I got to go. And so I moved to New York, and I thought I'd start all over again. And I moved to New York, and lo and behold, I was going to get rid of all my drug friends, and lo and behold, I had met new drug friends. I didn't know they had drug friends in New York. So then I moved to Japan, and then finally put an end to that that period. So I was. It takes a while. Anybody who's been an act knows that it's not something that you do over a period of months. It's a period you do over something that happens over a period of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not comparing, but I've been 30 months sober coming up. So I understand on some
level. I actually quit drinking myself. I'm about 4 months, 5 months sober.
No, very good. Obviously, you've made tons of things since then, but when you first get off drugs at that time, did you think that would hurt your creativity at all?
Oh, I did, and it did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I used to write at night. I would start at 10 p.m., and then it was caffeine, nicotine, alcohol, cocaine, round and round you go until it's 6 in the morning and you've done about 10 or 15 pages of work. But then I got married and I had children, and I realized I had to quit the night shift. And the last use I had for all that substance abuse was writing. I'd taken it out of all my social life, mm-hmm. but I still used it to write. And then it took me almost a year to learn how to write in the daytime. Because ever since college, I had been addicted to the night shift.
Mm.
And the night shift was based on abuse. It was based on cigarettes and booze and so forth, you know.
Yeah.
And stuff you can't do all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took me almost a year, a little less, of having an office and going in there every day and just, trying to write. And eventually I figured out how to write during the daytime.
Mm-hmm. Weirdly, you were like the leopard. You were nocturnal.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, it was one of the great seductions of writing and of substance abuse, is that, you know, the world goes to sleep and everybody is silent, and you ply your typewriter with substances, and out come these little people, and they start to play. And you know that if you don't give them something to drink, they're not going to come out. Mm-hmm. And so you say, okay, everybody's in bed now. You can come out.
How was the movie received when it first came out?
I think that Universal was disappointed. I think that they had greater expectations for it.
Mm-hmm.
The combination of, you know, the snob thing of saying it's not as good as the original, and then there's an uncomfortability about it that just like those two girls that were sitting ahead of Bruckheimer and I, you know, who are in many ways the target audience, and all of a sudden you saw them go white. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a problem I've had over the years. Penny Marshall, who is a good friend of mine, you know, said, your problem, Paul, is that you know exactly where the line is, and you go right up to the edge, and then you step over it. Penny, of course, never stepped over a line in her life.
Right. So how about the transformation scene? How did you get to that? You know, was there a thought like, how are we going to transform her into the cat? Because it's a lot different than, I kind of compare it to a werewolf movie, and she, you know, just busts out of her, out of the human.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, werewolf was also Universal right at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about the same mold makers and Tom Berman, and so Universal, in fact, had a kind of in-house team, just like they did in the old horror days. So a lot of that technology was there, and it was just a matter of, you know, how to do it. And it's, you know, very time-consuming. We did it as best we could.
You know, I think it looks cool. And how did you get David Bowie involved?
Well, I had done the film before I'd done with Giorgio Moroder, and I was doing this one with Giorgio. And Giorgio had brought in Blondie for American Gigolo. He had a big hit with that. And then he was saying, I'm talking about the music for this, and he said, you know, Bowie would be great for this. And he, at that time, was literally their hitmeister. You know, he had all those disco hits, one after another.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Giorgio calls you up and say, I've got a song I've written I'd like you to do. You know, David says, you know, well, come over to Montreux, we'll do it.
It's not me calling David.
It's Giorgio calling David.
Yeah, yeah. What did you, how much, do you have any input on, like, the actual song he does? Or what do you think of it when you hear it?
No, not a lot. I mean, I said I wanted to have a two-part thing. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to hook it to freeze frame. So I wanted to start out kind of soulful. Then when the when you have that freeze frame effect and he growls, then I said then we can turn it into a dance song.
Mm-hmm.
So that was all I, in terms of lyrics and any of that stuff, that was all David. Just the idea of having a lead up and then it bursts into a dance song.
Yeah.
You know, he did it, I found the words, with gasoline. Boom, boom, boom.
And yeah.
Then it takes
cool song. Yeah. Did you like the song when you first heard it? Do you think it fit the movie?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah.
And then it was a question of, the song was so good, you know, and you know, Tarantino sort of attacked me some years ago saying, when he put the song in his film, he said, it's such a great song, why did Sugar stick it at the end? And I knew it was a great song, and I knew it could have been a hit, but I had so planned to do the opening as this primitive religious ceremony,
mm-hmm,
that had a dance melody at the front. I just couldn't get my head around it.
Yeah, it wouldn't fit the beginning.
Yeah, but I knew that the song would have been even bigger if it had been up front.
But yeah, I mean, like you said, it just wouldn't fit. I love the beginning, by the way. The stylized lights, the reds, and where was that filmed with the tree and the panther
or
the?
That was on the stage at Universal.
Oh,
I'm in New Orleans now. We shot about half the film here in New Orleans, and then the rest we shot on stage at Universal City.
Okay. And you're not, you know, known as a horror guy, but are you a horror movie fan at all?
I am, but I don't. My feeling about a lot of these things is I've seen one of them. I saw a Spider-Man. I don't need to see any more.
Right.
And so, you know, I love to see, you know, like, a zombie movie, you know, it's really cool if it's well made, but I'm not going to watch a zombie TV series.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's what I guess separates me from the real fans is that they just watch anything and they watch. Well, I had one of my kids that just watch it over and over and over again.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I'm a fan. I kind of agree with you with the zombie thing. If you have a new take on zombies, it's cool. But I've seen basically every zombie movie is a take on a Romero zombie, and I don't need to see that over and over.
You know, I was just talking to who wants to do a zombie movie, but he's been trying to do it, and it'll be set in Central America in the political world, and that's Pablo Larraín.
Oh, interesting.
You know, he did Spencer, the last one, and Jackie, you know?
Yeah.
I was just talking to him. He's a very talented guy. He says, I've been trying to do a zombie movie. But there's a zombie movie I'd go see.
Yeah, I would suggest Train to Busan was a recent zombie movie. It's a Korean zombie movie, and it's a lot different than... a big difference to me is it's Korean, so there's no guns in it. So typically in all American movies, everyone's shooting everybody, especially in zombie movies. So it's how do they deal with this without, you know, being able to shoot it in the head?
Yeah.
But it's an interesting movie. Before I let you go, I do want to say I loved Card Counter. I'm not just a horror movie guy. I love all movies. And I saw Card Counter at the theater, and I thought it was great. But a big question about that, is that a hard movie to like make a trailer for, because people think it's about gambling, but it really is just on the surface about gambling, and you don't want to give away really what the movie's about. So was that just a hard movie to market?
Well, that's sort of the game it plays. I want people to think, oh, it's a cool gambling movie. And then I get my hooks in, and you realize I couldn't care less about who wins.
yeah, you know, not to spoil it, but yeah.
Yeah, but that's something I've been doing my whole life, is finding original metaphor for something that you think you know, like, you know, a taxi driver in movies was always the best friend. He was the funny guy, sat in the front seat, told you. And when I first came upon him, which was my first script, I looked at him and I didn't see that. I saw the black heart of existentialism. I saw loneliness, and I saw somebody trapped in a metal box going crazy. Mm-hmm. And so then you can make that metaphor come all alive, because people haven't made that association. People haven't associated poker playing with torture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or in the case of First Reformed, associated spiritual crisis with environmental collapse, or light sleeper midlife crisis with drug dealing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I'm sure people tell you this all the time, but Taxi Driver is my favorite movie. And so it's been very cool to have you here. But Card Counter is great, too. I do want to. I like to go into a movie, if possible, it's always possible, not really knowing anything about it. So I went into Card Counter not knowing anything about it. And so it really sucked me in, and I loved it.
Yeah, and at some point, you know, he said, wait, this is not about gambling.
Right. I was like, I honestly didn't even know. I went in and I was like, oh, I'll watch this. It's probably about gambling. And it comes up, Paul Schrader and produced by Martin Scorsese. I was like, oh, wow, this I'm happy I went to see this. And yeah, it was. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And I know you're a busy guy. Do you have anything? I know I think you're about to work on something.
Yeah, I'm in New Orleans now doing pre-production, and we started about 3 weeks. This is a film with Joel Edgerton and Sigourney Weaver and a young black actress who I'm very high on. And this, again, one of these metaphors, you know, only this time he's not a poker player, he's a gardener, he's a horticulturalist.
Mm.
And so... And some people have said to me that it was the third one of the trilogy was first performed in Card Counter. And I objected to that, and now I'm starting to realize that maybe it's true.
Interesting. Well, I'm looking forward to that. And really appreciate coming on and talk about Cat People for the 40th anniversary. I forgot to mention Malcolm McDowell is amazing in it. And do you have any quick stories about Malcolm McDowell?
We were talking about drugs earlier.
Yeah.
So I leave Los Angeles. Now I'm in New York. I run into John Hurt on the street. And John says, you know, have you ever taken a crack? I said, no, I haven't. John, it's the greatest thing. You got to take it. I said, okay. So I take it, and I just had the worst experience ever. I just fell into a pit. I just thought I was going to die. But God, I'm never going to do that again. Then I run into Malcolm McDowell 2 weeks later, and Malcolm says, hey, Jerry, ever tried crack? I tried it with John, and it was just like the worst thing ever. He said, oh, you must have had a bad experience. You got to try it again. So I tried it again, and it was just as bad the second time. So I dodged that bullet.
Well, very good. So that's a good message for everyone. Stay off the crack.
I don't suppose that's the kind of Malcolm McDowell story you wanted to hear.
It's one I've not heard before, so that's very good. But yeah, I'm a big fan of Malcolm McDowell. I interviewed him once, and I told him I used to watch a lot of his movies with my mom, and he just looked at me and he said, no wonder you're so fucked up. But that's my Malcolm. All right. Well, I appreciate this. It's been very fun to talk with you.
All right, Neil. Take care.
You as well. Bye. My name.
and I've been putting out fire with gasoline. Can never bend. See these eyes so-